Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm now going to cover Proverbs chapter 20, which I will entitle Proverbs of Solomon, part 11. Solomon begins in verse 1 of Proverbs 20. Wine is a mocker, strong drink a brawler, and whoever is intoxicated by it is not wise. Now, this is a very negative judgment on wine from Solomon, but actually some scriptures say that wine is a good thing. I can only assume that those scriptures mean that wine is a good thing when it is drunk in moderation. For example, we look at Deuteronomy 14:26. You may spend the money, referring to tithes for the Lord. You may spend the money on anything you want, cattle, sheep, wine, beer, or anything you desire. You to feast there in the presence of the Lord your God and rejoice with your family. Now, of course, the fundamentalist scholars, there's one named Teach Out that I found on the internet. They love to go into these great scholarly discussions of why wine means grape juice and that, therefore, alcohol is strictly prohibited, absolutely prohibited to the Christian. I remember reading one such booklet when I was young called Sipping Saints, aimed at people who do not take these affirmations of drink that's good as referring to grape juice only. In my view, the teetotaler position cannot be right when I look at Paul's lecture to the Corinthians about not getting drunk on communion wine. You don't get drunk on grape juice. 1 Corinthians 11:21, Paul says, "For at the meal, each one gets his own supper ahead of others, so one person is hungry while another gets drunk." D-R-U-N-K. You don't get drunk on grape juice, and so the Corinthians were using wine at their communion meal. Now, I know there are those out there of the King James-only fundamentalist persuasion who disagree with me. I know there are scholarly defenses of the King James position, even though I think the King James-only position is absolute, utter nonsense. And I somewhat tend to think that this teetotaler, this absolutist view of fundamentalist Christians who say that a Christian should never, ever drink wine is real hard to prove. I'd hate to have to defend that position in a court of law. Besides, these Christians, I'm sure, would take NyQuil, and NyQuil's got a lot more alcohol in it than the typical glass of wine or beer. At any rate, Solomon is not worried about stating the good uses of wine, as in Genesis 27:28, "May God give to you from the dew of the sky and from the richness of the land an abundance of grain and you wine." That's good, but Solomon is talking about the abuse of wine. He says wine is a mocker. As John Gill says, wine deceives a man and not only overcomes him before he is aware, but it promises him a pleasure which it does not give. But on the contrary, excessive drinking gives him pain and so mocks him. Yea, it exposes him to reproach and disgrace and to the mockery and derision of others, as well as it sets him to scoff at his companions and even to mock at religion and all that is good and serious. It also gets people pregnant, too, I might add. I never have understood why people want to get drunk. I never have, and I think that it's just plain stupid. It's not just immoral, which it is, but it's just plain stupid. It's injurious. Now, here's some other scriptures about drinking to excess. Proverbs 23, verses 29 through 30. Solomon says, "Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has contentions? Who has complaining? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes? Those who linger over wine, that's who." He didn't say that's who. He said, "Those who linger over wine, those who go to taste mixed wine." And I'm saying, that's who. That's who's miserable, who has sorrow and arguments and strife and complaining and wounds. Don't get drunk. That's just so obvious it's not even necessary to mention it, I wouldn't think, except when you look at how many alcoholics there are in this country and what horrible damage alcoholism does. I like to watch these alcoholic movies, Days of Wine and Roses with Jack Lemmon is one. There was another one with Susan Hayward. I forgot the name of it, but oh, she did a great job of a woman alcoholic. That's nothing to play around with, folks. It almost ruined my grandfather's life. My grandmother, she was biased, but she said, oh, he would have been governor of the state of South Carolina. He was mayor of my hometown, and he knew all the big shots. He knew Jimmy Burns, who was the Secretary of State under Franklin Roosevelt, and this was back when there was only the Democrat Party in South Carolina, and he completely bailed out of politics because he was an alcoholic. Proverbs 20, verse 2, the terror of a king is like the growling of a lion. He who provokes him to anger forfeits his own life. Here's another scripture, another proverb, says the same thing. Proverbs 19, 12, the king's wrath is like the roaring of a lion, but his favor is like dew on the grass. So here's the application of this proverb. Never make your boss angry. If you want to keep your job, just don't do it. Be nice to him. Help him out. Make him look good. Management 101. You provoke your boss, you might not forfeit your own life, but you'll forfeit your work life. We go now to Proverbs 20, verse 3. Solomon says, keeping away from strife is an honor for a man, but any fool will quarrel. The King James has any fool will meddle, which is similar. You meddle with somebody, you're going to end up in a quarrel with them. It's honorable to keep out of strife. I remember so well a businessman in my hometown. I remember his name. I never met him, but he was filing lawsuits all the time. He loved strife. There are some people that just love to fight all the time. They think it's a sport, but Solomon says staying out of strife is honorable. It's fools who want to get into fights all the time. Another scripture, another proverb that says the same thing, Proverbs 17:14, the beginning of strife is like letting out water, so abandon the quarrel before it breaks out. The letting out of water means water going through a hole in a dike or a dam, and it starts out small, but then as the water keeps flowing, the hole gets bigger and bigger, and then pretty soon the whole dam breaks. So plug the hole up as quick as you can. Same thing with quarreling. Plug up the quarrel as quick as you can before things get out of hand. Here's another good proverb that Solomon wrote, Proverbs 26:17. A person who is passing by and meddles in a quarrel that's not his is like one who grabs a dog by the ears. Now, if you grab a dog by the ears, said dog will plant his teeth into your flesh. They don't like that. I remember so well there was a church in a neighboring state, or a faraway state, actually, not immediately neighboring state, that was having all kinds of disputes because of a teacher that was there, and I'd had some dealings with that teacher, but I had absolutely no dealings with the people in the church. I knew nothing about it. And another person who I knew from house church conferences that I had sponsored, he asked me to come down there and help straighten out the strife. And I thought, no. I thought of this proverb, actually. I might as well go down there and pick up a dog by the ear. So I said, I'm sorry, I'm not going to do that. I'm not an elder in the church. I don't know anybody in the church. I'm not going to do it. And so this brother then publicly denounces me as a coward. No, there's a difference between being a coward and being smart. Proverbs 20, verse 4, the slacker does not plow during planting season. At harvest time he looks, and there is nothing. Now, I've and other proverbs have collected a bunch of proverbs against being lazy, so I won't repeat them here, but I will repeat one. Proverbs 19:24, the sluggard buries his hand in the dish, but will not even bring it back to his mouth. And that's laziness. You're so hungry, but you haven't got enough energy to bring the food from the plate to your mouth. Well, the slacker, as the Homer Christian Study Bible translates that word, the sluggard, does not plow during planting season. Now, in order to understand this, we need to understand a little bit about Jewish agriculture. The former rains soften the ground, which are necessary for plowing. The former rains were during October, according to BibleHistory.com, according to a website called DyingWorld.org. The former rains started at the end of October or the beginning of November. Now, once the former rains were finished, you're at the beginning of November, so you're into the winter time. So then the plowing was done in the winter to prepare for the planting in the early spring of the barley harvest. Now that's simple enough. So the slacker does not plow during planting season, which would be during the winter. Now other translations, instead of putting planting season for the Hebrew there, planting season is the Holman Christian Study Bible. Here's some other translations. The Holman Christian Study Bible note says, plow in winter. The slacker does not plow in winter. The American Standard Version, Bible in Basic English, the Darby Translation, and Young's Literal Translation all have winter. The slacker does not plow during winter. And so that seems straightforward enough. But then the NASB has doesn't plow during autumn, even though it's literally winter. God's Word Translation also says fall. And the note in the God's Word translation says, fall was the start of the planting season in Palestine. Well, if you include the early rains, I guess you could say that fall was the beginning of the planting season. But that's being a little bit loose. The KJV has, the slacker does not plow during the cold. And the NAB, the New American Bible, has, the slacker does not plow, the sluggard does not plow during seed time. Well, all of this raises a little bit of confusion in my mind. I have decided that the Jews' agricultural practices are more confusing to me than eschatology and the problem of free will and the predestination of God. I don't have any problem with eschatology and the predestination of God anymore. I am satisfied on that, but I am not satisfied on how the Jews did their agriculture. Now, to give you an example of how confusing this is, I'm going to give you 7 commentators' opinions as to when the plowing and planting season were. Now remember, you got to plow before you plant. There are several things you have to look at. When the rain fell, the former rain, and then you plow after the former rain, and then you plant after you plow. Here's what Adam Clark says. They begin their plowing in the latter end of September and sow their early wheat by the middle of October. Wheat? I thought that was the barley harvest. Barns. Plowing time in Palestine is in November and December, when the wind blows commonly from the north. Now, that makes a lot of sense, because if the latter rain ends in late October, early November, then plowing time would be in November and December. So I like what Barnes says there. Benson says plowing and planting season was at the latter end of autumn and toward winter, or early in the spring. So Benson goes from autumn to winter to spring. John Gill says, in the time of autumn, which is the time of plowing. Well, I thought the plowing was in the wintertime. Gill says, no, it's the time of autumn. Gill says, no, it's the time of autumn, which is the time of plowing, when it begins to be cold. I thought it was wintertime when it was time to be plowing. Kyle and Delich say this, the time of plowing and sowing with the harvest or early rains followed the fruit harvest from October to December. So Kyle and Delich at least has the plowing starting in December, which is close. It's wintertime. Poole says it's in the autumn and towards winter. That's roughly where we're talking about now. Pulpit commentator says plowing was in the winter. Well, from all that, this is what I gather. At the end of October, the beginning of November, the early rain fell, softening up the ground for plowing to begin at the beginning of November. That's winter, and that's what our text says. The slacker does not plow during winter, but diligent people do plow during winter, and that's all through October, December. And then at harvest time, which is in the early spring, sometime during that time between November and December to early April, let's say, there was some planting done of the seeds, and then it grew, the barley harvest grew in late March, early April, I'm estimating. And so then it's time for harvest. Now, I could be wrong on that, but I can't find somebody to just write it down. What are the seasons of Israel as far as the rains, the plowing, the planting, and the harvesting? I would love to find such an article. But at any rate, that's a little rabbit trail. The point is that lazy people do not put in the work that's necessary to reap a harvest. Now, let's face it, most everything we do requires a lot of work where you don't get any return. Building a house, oh my gosh, the work you have to do to put into the foundation before you get to live in that house. You can't be lazy. Paul had to deal with lazy Christians, thought the day of the Lord had already come, and so they're living in the new heavens and the new earth, and they don't have to work anymore. 2 Thessalonians 3:10, in fact, when we were with you, Thessalonians, this is what we commanded you. If anyone isn't willing to work, he should not eat. We go now to Proverbs 20, verse 5. Solomon says, a plan in the heart of a man is like deep water, but a man of understanding draws it out. Now, this man could be a good man or he could be a bad man. Let's assume he's a good man for a minute. The man of understanding wants to get wisdom from this good man. But these men are not apt to freely share their wisdom because it looks arrogant, and so they're modest, and so they keep it quiet. And so the man of understanding goes to this good man whose wisdom is like deep water, and he starts drawing it out. Tell me, sir, how do I find a good wife? Tell me, sir, how do I raise a godly family? Tell me, sir, how do I have good church life? Tell me, sir, how can I be a good witness? The man of understanding draws out that knowledge, like a man draws out water with a pail. Well, now let's assume for a minute that man there is meant by Solomon to be a bad man. Well, in that case, the man of understanding will draw out the plans in the heart of this bad man. They will stick their pail into the water of the bad man's plans so that they can take that water out and examine it so they won't be caught by the bad man. I think it's a good man, in my humble opinion. But to show that a man of understanding has to draw wisdom out from the heart of another man, it shows that some men just must be pumped. It's like getting water out of a deep well. You got to stick your pail down there and get it. It also shows that the wisdom in the heart of a man, that wisdom which is like deep water, it's useless unless it can be well explained to others. What good is a water in a well if people can't drink it? There's a similar proverb to this in Proverbs 18:4. The words of a man's mouth are deep waters. There's that phrase again, deep waters. The words of a man's mouth are deep. The plans in their heart are deep in Proverbs 25 and Proverbs 18:4. It's the words that are deep. The fountain of wisdom is a bubbling brook. So, of course, there the man is assumed to be a good man with wisdom, and I think that's what's meant not only in Proverbs 18:4, but also in Proverbs 20, verse 5. Now, these deep waters, they can be deep metaphysically because they're hard to understand, and the wise man understands them, or they could be deep because there are so many wise words in the man's mouth, and there are so many good plans in the man's heart. Or it could be both, metaphysically deep and quantitatively deep. Find wise people and start drawing from that well. I did that when I got married. Before I was married, I talked to people that were married. I asked people's opinions about, what do you think about marrying Linda? Oh, she's the most wonderful wife in the world. You'd be a fool to let her go. Then I would go to people who had kids before I had children, and I would say, how would you raise children? I would read James Dobson, Focus on the Family, How to Raise Children, because I didn't know anything about raising children. We go now to Proverbs 20, verse 6. Many a man proclaims his own loyalty, but who can find a trustworthy man? In other words, this is a false proclamation of loyalty. I'll follow you to the death. Sounds like people working for Donald Trump when he was president. They all swore loyalty, but after a while, a lot of them flew the coop. Other translations, besides loyalty, many a man proclaims his own goodness, the KJV says. Many a man proclaims his own unfailing love, the NIV says. Solomon states in this proverb that it's hard to find such a man. Who can find a trustworthy man? David, his father, said the same thing in Psalms chapter 12, verse 1. Help, Lord, for the godly man ceases to be, for the faithful disappear from among the sons of men. Sounds just like our government today. Our government is run by a bunch of immoral fools. We go now to Proverbs 20, verse 7. A righteous man who walks in his integrity, how blessed are his sons after him. The sons of the righteous are blessed. How? Could be in this life with temporal goods or spiritually blessed. It could be in the next life with eternal spiritual blessings. We don't know, but we do know that children of righteous people are blessed. Now, a lot of people will say, well, it's not fair. It's not fair for children to get the blessings of their parents. Well, you can complain about that all you want, but that's the way it is. And how about these people who are born of crack addicts? The mother's on crack cocaine and the kids are born addicted to coke and that sort of thing. Well, that's not fair either, but that's the way it is. And people will say, well, I didn't sin. Adam did. And he passed his sin on to me. It's not fair. Well, are you participating in the sins of Adam? Have you done what Adam did? Oh, yes, you have. So that's fair. For those who have a bad start in life, there's always Jesus who can take the most miserable human being and make them inherit the earth. Jesus said, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. So we need to quit worrying about what's fair or not, and we need to start looking at what our potential in Christ is. I wish I hadn't been born of an atheist and a non-believing mother. I really do, but hey, that's the way it is. Here's some other scriptures about the passed down effects of righteousness. Psalms 37, verse 26, the author of which is David. David says, all day long the righteous man is gracious and lends, and his descendants are a blessing. The descendants are blessed themselves, and then they're a blessing to the Father. Psalms 112, verses 1 through 2, the author of which is unknown, says this, praise the Lord, how blessed is the man who fears the Lord, who greatly delights in his commandments. His descendants will be mighty on earth. The generation of the upright will be blessed. So a righteous man will have mighty descendants and blessed descendants. We go now to Proverbs 20, verse 8. Solomon says, "A king who sits on the throne of justice disperses all evil with his eyes." I'm assuming Solomon is putting himself into the category of a just king here. A just king disperses all evil. It is the duty of the civil magistrate to punish crime, not merely the optional right of him to punish crime. He disperses it with his eyes. That means he just looks at it and the evil disappears because the evil people are scared of the possessor of those eyes. We see a similar proverb in Proverbs 16:10, "A divine decision is in the lips of the king. His mouth should not err in judgment." He needs to be right. He needs to be just. We go now to Proverbs 20, verse 9. "Who can say, I have cleansed my heart, I am pure from my sin?" Rhetorical question, and Solomon expects a nobody for an answer. Nobody can say that they have cleansed their heart and that they are pure from sin. Here's what Adam Clark says this, "The heart of man is naturally unclean. The mind, conscience, understanding, will, and affections, there is no part clean. All are defiled with sin. And though there is such a thing as a pure or clean heart, yet not is made so by men, it is God that has made the heart that can only make it clean or create a clean heart in men. It is not to be done by themselves or by anything that they can do. It is done only by the grace of God and blood of Christ." Here's some other scriptures that express the same thing. Eliphaz is speaking in Job 15:14 and says, "What is man that he should be pure, or he who is born of a woman that he should be righteous?" In other words, there is no man that's pure and righteous. Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 7:20, "Indeed, there is not a righteous man on earth who continually does good and who never sins." So when Paul says there are none that are righteous, Romans 3, verse 20, I think it is, he's just repeating what was already known. In fact, I don't see how anybody can deny that. How can you look at what's on the internet today and say, "Oh, man's basically good"? Really? Why don't you tell me that 2 plus 2 equals 5? We go down to Proverbs 20, verse 10. "Differing weights and differing measures, both of them are abominable to the Lord." Differing means that there are one set of weights for buying and another set of weights for selling. For example, if a merchant is buying something from a vendor, let's say some grain, farmer is selling some grain, and so the merchant says, "Okay, on one side of the scales, I have my little container here. It's labeled 1 bushel. Actually, it's 1.25 bushels, and so the unsuspecting farmer pours his grain into the container, and he pours 1.25 bushels of grain into that container, and the merchant then pays for 1 bushel. He got an extra 0.25 bushel. Likewise, if the merchant is selling to a buyer, a customer, the customer needs to pay, and so the merchant says, "I need you to pay me 100 grams of gold." So he puts his weight on the left side of the scale. The weight is labeled 100 grams, but it's actually 110 grams. And so when the buyer puts his gold down on the other side of the scale, he thinks he's putting down 100 grams of gold, but he's putting down 110 grams of gold, and thus he is cheated. Well, of course, that's obviously abominable to the Lord. Here's some other scriptures that say the same thing. Solomon says in Proverbs 11:1, "A false balance is an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is his delight." Proverbs 16:11, "A just balance and scales belong to the Lord. All the weights of the bag are his concern." Proverbs 20, verse 23, "Differing weights are detestable to the Lord, and dishonest scales are unfair." And Moses says in Leviticus 19:35-36, "In the law you shall do no wrong in judgment, in measurement of weight or capacity. You shall have just balances, just weights, a just ephah," that's a measure of grain, for example, a solid measure, "and a just hin," that's a liquid measure. "I am the Lord your God who brought you out from the land of Egypt." Proverbs 20, verse 11, "It is by his deeds that a lad distinguishes himself if his conduct is pure and right." This calls to mind Matthew 7:16, "You shall know them by their fruits." A lad's got to do something. He's got to distinguish himself by his conduct, not just by his words. Now, children are actually easier to figure out than adults are. As Adam Clark says, a child is easily detected when he has done evil. He immediately begins to excuse and vindicate himself and profess his innocence, almost before accusation takes place. And that should be a warning to parents to check evil tendencies early. As soon as they are detected, don't let kids get away with that. This reminds me, one time I was teaching computer program at a university, and I got two students' programs and looked at them, and they were every dot, every molecule, exactly the same. Even the print was the same darkness. You couldn't have told those two computer programs apart any more than you could tell a perfect counterfeit of the American dollar bill from a real one. You just couldn't do it. So I gave them an F for cheating. And those two students came to me and swore up and down they weren't cheating, that they did not help each other on the program. It just came out that way. And I remember thinking, you know, not only you're a cheater, but you must think I'm a fool. At any rate, just like in so many other areas of life, actions speak louder than words. We go now to Proverbs 20, verse 12. The hearing ear and the seeing eye, the Lord has made both of them. As Adam Clark says, every good we possess comes from God, and we should neither use our eyes nor our ears nor anything we possess, but in strict subserviency to his will. So if that's what the proverb means, it means that man can hear and understand, and he can see and understand. But remember, it's God that gave you the ability to hear and understand and see and understand. Or it could mean, as Jameson Fawcett and Brown rather say, that God will know all you do. You think you're hearing stuff and keeping it from God, and you think you're seeing stuff and God doesn't know, but hey, the Lord knows about hearing and seeing because he made that ear of yours that hears and your eye that sees. Psalms 94:9, the author of which is unknown, says, he who planted the ear, does he not hear? He who formed the eye, does he not see? God is omniscient, folks. He knows everything. We go now to Proverbs 20:13. Solomon says, do not love sleep or you will become poor. Open your eyes and you will be satisfied with food. Now, this is one of the many proverbs that has to do with diligence as opposed to not being lazy. Some other scripture is Proverbs 10:4. Poor is he who works with a negligent hand, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. Proverbs 12:24. The hand of the diligent will rule, but the slack hand will be put to forced labor. Proverbs 19:15. Laziness cast into a deep sleep, and an idle man will suffer hunger. Proverbs 24:30-34, I passed by the field of the sluggard and by the vineyard of the man lacking sense, and behold, it was completely overgrown with thistles. Its surface was covered with nettles, and its stone wall was broken down. When I saw, I reflected upon it. I looked and received instruction. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, then your poverty will come as a robber and your want like an armed man. Proverbs 26, verses 13-16, the sluggard says, there is a lion in the road. A lion is in the open square. Of course, the sluggard doesn't do anything about getting up and getting rid of the lion. Quite frankly, I have a little bit of sympathy with that sluggard. As the door turns on its hinges, so does the sluggard on his bed. We're continuing in Proverbs 26 and verse 15, the sluggard buries his hand in the dish. He is wary of bringing it to his mouth again. So lazy, can't even feed himself. The sluggard is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who can give a discreet answer. Proverbs 19:24. The sluggard buries his hand in the dish, but will not even bring it back to his mouth. That's a repeat of Proverbs 26, verse 15. Proverbs 6:6-11. Go to the ant, you slacker. Observe its ways and become wise. Without leader, administrator, or ruler, it prepares its provisions. In summer, it gathers its food during harvest. How long will you stay in bed, you slacker? When will you get up from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the arms to rest, and your poverty will come like a robber, your need like a bandit. Solomon must have really been upset with lazy people because he has probably more proverbs against laziness than he has against adulteresses. Adam Clark says something that balances this off a little bit. He says, sleep is a blessing that can turn into a curse. As one who loves to sleep, I appreciate that comment. We go now to Proverbs 20, verse 14. Bad, bad, says the buyer, but when he goes his way, then he boasts. This reminds me, one time I was walking some rural property that I wanted to buy. My father was going to help me buy it, and he was in the real estate business. And so the broker, the real estate broker, was showing us around the property. And my father came up with one thing after another. The water won't drain here. It's going to cost a fortune to clear the trees from here. The location is terrible. He just went on and on. And I remember thinking, well, why do I want to buy this property? And then when we were alone after the broker had left, my father said, that's a good piece of property. You need to buy that. He was trying to jack the price down. Well, to me, that's just business. That's nothing immoral about that. When you read Proverbs 20:14, you don't see Solomon saying that this is immoral. He just says this is the way it is. Bad, bad, says the Bible. When he goes his way, then he boasts. Well, is Solomon saying that's a bad thing? Well, our commentators seem to think it's a horrible thing. Here's what Adam Clark said. Are such honest men? Is such knavery actionable? Can such be punished only in another world? That's just business. That's not something immoral, Adam Clark. What are you saying? Now, St. Augustine, as quoted by one of my commentators, who says that Augustine tells us a pleasant story on this subject. A certain mountebank, a mountebank was a fraud, a certain mountebank published in the full theater that at the next entertainment he would show to every man present what was in his heart. The time came, and the concourse was immense. All waited with death-like silence to hear what he would say to each. He stood up, and in a single sentence redeemed his pledge. You all wish to buy cheap and sell dear. Well, okay, that was what was in their heart. That's what's in your heart. That's what's in my heart. There's nothing wrong with that. Otherwise, you can't make a profit. You can't stay in business. Now, I realize Augustine was not a businessman. He lived before capitalism, really. I mean, people love to jump on businessmen. I remember I was teaching business ethics, and somebody from the social sciences in my college came up to me after class one day and says, what are you teaching? I said, business ethics. He says, isn't that oxymoronic? And I just laughed because people think that if just as soon as you're in business, you're unethical. Well, you could say the same thing about lawyers and doctors, too. How about politics? Every profession has been tainted with sin. There's nothing wrong, though, with saying buy cheap and sell dear. Now, Augustine's mountebank, this fraud, he probably charged money. Well, they voluntarily paid it. The audience did, so I don't see how you can say the mountebank's a fraud. He's just smart. We go now to Proverbs 20, verse 15. Solomon says, there is gold and an abundance of jewels, but the lips of knowledge are a more precious thing. So here's a proverb telling us that wisdom is more precious than gold. Here are two other scriptures saying the same thing. Job, in Job 28, says this, but where can wisdom be found, and where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its value, nor is it found in the land of the living. The deep says, it is not in me, and the sea says, it is not with me. Pure gold cannot be given in exchange for it, nor can silver be weighed as its price. It cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir, in precious onyx or sapphire. Gold or glass cannot equal it, nor can it be exchanged for articles of fine gold. Coral and crystal are not to be mentioned, and the acquisition of wisdom is above that of pearls. The topaz of Ethiopia cannot equal it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. Job makes the point quite clear there. Solomon says in Proverbs 3, verses 14 through 15, for her, referring to wisdom, for her profit is better than the profit of silver, and her gain better than fine gold. She is more precious than jewels, and nothing you desire compares with her. We go now to Proverbs 20, verse 16. Take his garment when he becomes surety for a stranger, and for foreigners hold him in pledge. Now, I don't know about you, but when I read that, I am completely flummoxed. My mind draws a blank. What in the world is Solomon talking about here? Well, before I get into that, let's talk about some preliminary matters. First of all, a surety. What is a surety? That is a promise to pay the debt that somebody else owes. If the debtor defaults on his payment, you stand in his shoes and you make the payment. The surety makes the payment. Now, the question arises, does Solomon make an absolute prohibition against entering into sureties? Well, John Gill doesn't think so. He says the prohibition against sureties is only against rash sureties, stupid sureties. As Gill says, it is a rash and inconsiderate entering into suretyship that is here cautioned against. Doing it without inquiring into and having sufficient knowledge of the person engaged for, and without considering whether able to answer the obligation if required, without hurting a man's self and family. Otherwise, suretyship may lawfully be entered into, and good be done by it, and no hurt to the surety himself and family. Well, as I think about that, I think about lending money, because basically a surety is a potential lender of money, a potential creditor. There's nothing wrong with being a creditor. Nothing wrong with charging interest if it's not a charity loan in the Old Testament. So I will assume that reasonable sureties are perfectly okay, as Gil does. And I will also give you my thoughts here on how one could make a case for a sensible surety agreement. First of all, the surety must rationally weigh out the risk. He should know that he can stand the hit if the debtor for whose debt the surety has guaranteed the payment, if that debtor can't pay his creditor, well then you better be able to pay the creditor and it won't destroy you financially. That's the first requirement. The second requirement is you have a good reason for doing it. Perhaps it's a family member. And you realize if the family member can't pay the debt back, you will just cover it and life will go on. Or if you are in business, you get paid for it, like banks with letters of credit. Third requirement, you will not expect to get paid back from the defaulted debtor, the person for whom you made the surety. You are willing to let it go as a gift. Now, of course, if that debtor is reasonable, he'll pay it back when he gets the money. But if he doesn't, you're willing to let it go. Now, that's not scriptural. This is just me giving you some wisdom. Here's some other proverbs concerning sureties. Proverbs 17:18. A man lacking in sense pledges and becomes guarantor in the presence of his neighbor. Proverbs 22, verses 26 through 27. Do not be among those who give pledges, among those who become guarantors for debts. If you have nothing with which to pay, why should he take your bed from under you? Now notice, this is obviously a surety who doesn't have enough money to pay because he's losing his bed. If you're down to that, if you don't have any loose cash to pay a debt and the debtor gets to come take the bed out from under you, you're much too poor to be entering into surety contracts. So that proverb really doesn't have anything to do with situations where the surety has money to cover the debt. Proverbs 6:1, Solomon says, "My son, if you have become surety for your neighbor, have given for a pledge for a stranger, you have been trapped by the words of your lips, ensnared by the words of your mouth." Do this then, my son, and free yourself, for you have put yourself in your neighbor's power. Go humble yourself and plead with your neighbor. When you're in debt, you're in somebody's power. You're a slave. So get out of that foolish surety contract, Solomon is saying. Now let's return to verse 16 in Proverbs 20. Take his garment when he becomes surety for a stranger. What does that mean? And for foreigners, hold him in pledge. Well, before we get into it, let's look at the two words here that might bear on our understanding, stranger and foreigners. This is the NASB translation. Take his garment when he becomes surety for a stranger, and for foreigners, hold him in pledge. I'm going to assume that stranger and foreigners refer to the same person. I've got 8 different translations in front of me here, and most of the translations have some form of stranger in the second part of the couplet, verse 20, and all of the translations have either another or a form of stranger in the first part of the couplet. So I'm going to assume that we're talking about the same person here, this stranger and this foreigner. So my first question is this verse a prohibition against surety given only to strangers? In other words, the verse leaves open the option that you can give a surety to a son who's not a stranger or to an Israelite who's not a foreigner. And since I always take the looser interpretation, if I can do it, I'm going to assume that that's true, that Solomon is just denigrating sureties for aliens, proselytes, people who come into the country that are not Jews, foreigners. Now, the next question is why would he do that? Why would he mention foreigners as somebody for whom you should not give a surety? Well, as Gill and Clark both point out, the guarantor, the surety, is in a risky position. He's guaranteed a foreigner's loan. Foreigners are less creditworthy than local Jewish people. They can fly the coop and go back to their home country, and they escape the jurisdiction of a Israelite court. Now, if that interpretation is correct, it would make sense then that if a surety is going to guarantee the loan for a foreigner, he better take the foreign debtor's garment as security. So in case the foreigner doesn't pay his debt back, the surety has a garment for collateral, because a foreigner is a higher credit risk than a local Jewish person. And that's how I'm going to take it. Now let's look at this word, take his garment. You could take garments for collateral, but you had to return the garment before sunset to the debtor. And in this case, the person whose loan was guaranteed is the debtor of the surety. The debtor has his own debtor, and then the debtor is the debtor of the surety. And if the surety takes the garment in security, he had to return it back to that debtor when the sun sets. Exodus 22, verse 26. If you ever take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, you are to return it to him before the sun sets. The reason for that was so that the debtor wouldn't freeze to death, to protect poor people who didn't have any other way of keeping warm. Now, I just assumed that that garment was security that the surety was taking in case he had to pay off on the underlying loan. But there's another interpretation that has been suggested. This could be a prophecy of what will happen when the loan that is guaranteed goes bad, when the person for whom the surety contract was entered into, when that debtor can't pay off his loan to his creditor, then the guarantor will lose his garment because he'll have to sell it in order to pay off the debt to the debtor. Take his garment. In other words, take the garment away from the surety. That's actually a fairly reasonable interpretation, so I won't be dogmatic on that, but I like the other interpretation better, that the surety needs to get his collateral because a loan to a stranger, to a foreigner, is risky. Now, there's one other comment I want to make about this. Almost all the translations say that the garment is to be held in pledge for a foreigner. The King James says the garment should be taken as a pledge, or a pledge should be taken of a strange woman, not a foreigner, but a strange woman. That is an outlier of a translation. Nobody else translates it that way. Gill and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown try to interpret it that way, and they say that what the proverb means is that one who lends to a lewd woman has bad financial standing. In other words, if somebody's lending money to a whore, he's not of good character, and therefore, if he borrows money from you, he's likely not to pay you back, so you need to take some pledge from him. I don't believe that because that's such a off-the-wall translation. I said there was one more thing I wanted to say. Actually, there was two more things, because here's the last thing I want to say about this verse. In the NASB translation, the verse says, "And for foreigners, hold him in pledge." Hold him in pledge? A person is not collateral, unless you have slavery, I guess, if the debtor doesn't pay off the debt. So you pay off the debt, and then you take the person for whom the surety was made, you take him into slavery. I don't believe that's what it means. Most of the other translations have it. For example, the NIV says, "Hold it in pledge," referring to the garment. Young's Literal Translation says, "Take his garment, dot, 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 and for strangers pledge it," the garment, the shirt, the collateral. We go now to Proverbs 20, verse 17. Solomon says, "Bread obtained by falsehood is sweet to a man, but afterwards his mouth will be filled with gravel." Similar proverb can be found in chapter 9, verse 17. "Stolen water is sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant." Reminds me of one time when I was an adolescent, I shoplifted a 10-cent slingshot from a 10-cent store. 10 cents. Even at that young age, I could have afforded to buy it, but oh no, it was fun stealing it. But then afterwards, I felt so guilty. I'm still feeling guilty. If it hadn't been for the blood of Jesus, I'd still feel guilty about stealing that slingshot. Years later, I went back to pay the store back, and it had gone bankrupt, and I couldn't pay it back. So, you know, as far as I could, I tried to make restitution and couldn't, but that thing really ate me up. My mouth was filled with gravel. We go down to Proverbs 20, verse 18. "Prepare plans by consultation and make war by wise guidance." War is a serious business. You better have some serious and wise counselors if you're going to do something like get into a war. "A war should never be entered into rashly. What should be considered? Well, is there a just and lawful cause for the war? Can the war be paid for? Will it probably be won?" Those are hard questions. Adam Clark says most wars are wars of injustice, ambition, and aggrandizement and caprice. Now, that's absolutely true. I have been soaked in medieval European history, and all the wars they fight are just trying to grab somebody's territory. Just absolute greed, or extend my dynasty. Let my children have more land. And there's no real... The law that really is just, in my opinion, is to stop Adolf Hitler. That war was just. And I think if you're in a situation where one country cuts off your ability to even function economically, well, that's just too, if you don't have a court you can appeal to. For example, in the American Revolution, I think it was just when the idiotic mercantilist policies of the British government didn't allow the colonists to carry out normal marketplace functions, they couldn't make a living. So I think that was just, although I have Christian friends who disagree with me on that. I won't even get into the war between the states, because I'm a Southerner, I'm somewhat sensitive about that. But war is a serious business. I will say this, I don't think that if I'd have been around here in South Carolina when that war was declared, I don't think I would have participated in it. And Abraham Lincoln, he decided he's going to make war. And it was not to free the slaves, by the way, not at the beginning. It was to preserve the Union. You can prove that very easily. It didn't become a war to stop slavery until halfway through the war, about 1863. And so Lincoln was willing to get a whole bunch of people killed to save the Union. Really? Is it worth getting all those people killed and all the horrible maiming and destruction of people's economic livelihoods and families and horrible stuff that happened? That war was horrible. I've been on all the battlefields. Was it really worth it? Now, of course, I've got hindsight. Most of the people that were involved in that horrible war thought it was going to be over in a couple of months, both North and South. Battle of Bull Run, all the fine ladies and the noble gentlemen from Washington got in their horses and carriage, and they carried their picnic lunches to the battlefield so they could watch the Yankees beat the rebels and get this thing over with. It didn't happen. Southerners were the same way. They thought it was going to be over in a month or two. This happens all the time. Wars are unpredictable, and they kill people, and they should be avoided at all cost. If you're going to get into a war, it should only be a defensive war, and you better consider the cost, and can you win it? There's no point in getting into a war that you are most likely going to lose. Here's some other scriptures along those lines. Proverbs 11:14, where there is no guidance, the people fall, but in abundance of counselors, there is victory. Proverbs 15:22, without consultation, plans are frustrated, but with many counselors, they succeed. Proverbs 24:6, for by wise guidance, you will wage war, and in abundance of counselors, there is victory. We move down to Proverbs 20:19. He who goes about as a slanderer reveals secrets. Therefore, do not associate with a gossip. A gossip is, as one of my commentators says, him that flattereth with his lips. A flatterer is likely to entice secrets out of one. You flatter somebody, they loosen up, they start telling you stuff. Ah, now the flatterer turns into a gossip because he's got secret knowledge and he goes around, tells other people, and pretty soon your secrets have been exposed. A gossip is usually not spreading good news about you. He is slandering you. The word is used right here. He goes about as a slanderer. So be careful. Don't just talk to people knowing that they are going to most likely spread it around. We go to Proverbs 20:20. He who curses his father or his mother, his lamp will go out in time of darkness. What is his lamp that will go out because he cursed his mother and father? We'll give you four options. The lamp is the man's eye that goes out, literally. The lamp is a metaphor for his happiness. The man's happiness will go out, the man who curses his father or mother. Option number three, the lamp of a man who curses his father or mother is the spirit of that man, the spirit which gave him life. Option number four, the lamp that goes out for the man who curses his father and his mother is his posterity. Now let's look at those four options. His lamp, his eye will go out. Proverbs 30:17, the eye that mocks a father and scorns a mother, the ravens of the valley will pick it out and the young eagles will eat it. Well, I think that's metaphorical. So I don't think it's a literal eye that's going to go out. I don't think that's the lamp that's being referred to here. How about a metaphor for happiness? That's more reasonable. The curser's lamp, his happiness, will go out. Job 18:5. Indeed, the light of the wicked goes out and the flame of the fire gives no light. Now, Bildad spoke that, and sometimes he's wrong, of course, but he's right there. Proverbs 13:9, the light of the righteous rejoices, but the lamp of the wicked goes out. And it just sounds like, you know, things are not good. You're living in darkness. Your human happiness is gone. I can go with that. Option number three, his lamp will go out, refers to his spirit, the spirit that gave him life. In other words, when his lamp goes out, he dies. Proverbs 20, verse 27, the spirit of man is the lamp of the Lord, searching all the innermost parts of his being. We'll examine that proverb in just a minute. Exodus 21, 17, he who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. That sounds like a lamp going out. That law is repeated in Leviticus 20, verse 9. If there is anyone who curses his father or his mother, he shall surely be put to death. He has cursed his father or his mother, his blood guiltiness upon him. Put to death. His lamp will go out. Proverbs 24, verse 20. For there will be no future for the evil man. The lamp of the wicked will be put out. Well, that's not really, that doesn't actually refer to death. So that's a little bit ambiguous. But I think it's reasonable to say that a cursing man's lamp will go out means he's going to die. Option number 4, his posterity will die. Proverbs 24, 20. For there will be no future for the evil man. The lamp of the wicked will be put out. No future. Well, that could refer to his future life on earth. He's unhappy. So it's actually ambiguous as to what it means. Adam Clark thinks his posterity could be all of it. Probably not his physical eyes pecked out by a raven, but he's going to be unhappy. He's going to die. He's going to be unhappy. He's going to die. And his posterity is going to be wiped out. That's serious business, cursing your mother or father. Here's some other scriptures referring to one's lamp being put out. Job 21, verse 17, Job is speaking. He says, how often is the lamp of the wicked put out, or does their calamity fall on them? Does God apportion destruction in his anger? Now, I think if I remember correctly, Job is saying that a lot of times the wicked prosper, they don't get snuffed out like they should. I'm speaking from my memory. My memory could be wrong, but I believe that's what he's saying. But the point is that expression, the lamp of the wicked put out, does God apportion destruction? There, put out means destroyed. If your lamp is put out, you're dead. Finally, in Proverbs 13, verse 9, Solomon says, the light of the righteous rejoices, but the lamp of the wicked goes out. So the moral of that psalm is, you don't want your lamp to go out. Don't say bad things about your father or your mother. I remember one time, a young woman from the north of America, who I was somewhat romantically interested in when I was a single man, she had occasion to run into my mother, and she started saying some very uncomplimentary things about my mother, and I remember it to this day. Now, as it turns out, that everything she said was actually true. But hey, don't talk about my mother or my father that way. No, talk about your own mother, not mine. Because I was raised to say, you honor your father and your mother. And that doesn't mean that your father and mother are perfect. They are not. But you still honor them, and you certainly don't run down somebody else's mother or father. We go down to Proverbs 20, verse 21. Solomon says, an inheritance gained hurriedly at the beginning will not be blessed in the end. Now, this inheritance, which is gained hurriedly, it could either be gained unlawfully or perhaps lawfully. If it was gained unlawfully, here's what Gill says, of a man setting out in the world in trade and business, and which sometimes is got lawfully, and this must be accepted from this proverb, but generally what is got hastily and in a short time is got unlawfully and so does not prosper. And so Gill assumes that this inheritance that Solomon's talking about in verse 21, this inheritance gained hurriedly is an unlawful acquisition of wealth. I'm not sure he's right about that. You could say this was a lawful acquisition of wealth, gained hurriedly because you got it, boom, instantly. You inherited it when your father died. So Solomon could be referring to any inheritance which is gained without work and labor. Now there's an equivalent English proverb to this, easy come, easy go. How can you get an inheritance hurriedly without work or labor? Well, you could get an unexpected inheritance from a friend or from a relative. You could get a quote-unquote inheritance, loosely interpreted, not from a death, but from a speculative investment, a lucky hit. You might win the lottery. These kinds of acquisitions of wealth lead to idleness, pride, fraud, and knavery. If you look at modern life, this is the general pattern. The poor grandfather makes the fortune. His son manages the fortune. His grandson squanders the fortune. So Solomon is describing something that is true in all times, in all generations, all throughout history. If you work hard for something, you will manage it and keep it from being dissipated because you know how hard it was to get. But if it's just given to you, you're not as careful with it. And as a result, The person receiving such easy money will not be blessed in the end. He'll lose it. Here's some other scriptures. Proverbs 23, verse 4. Do not weary yourself to gain wealth. Cease from your consideration of it. Proverbs 28:20. A faithful man will abound with blessings, but he who makes haste to be rich will not go unpunished. 1 Timothy 6, 9 through 10. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, and some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. We go now to Proverbs 20, verse 22. Solomon says, do not say, I will repay evil. Wait for the Lord, and he will save you. Now, that proverb is reminiscent of other scriptures. For example, in the law, Deuteronomy 32, 35. Vengeance is mine, says God, and retribution. In due time, their foot will slip, for the day of their calamity is near, referring to evil people, and the impending things are hastening upon them. Vengeance is God's, Deuteronomy 32, verse 41. If I sharpen my flashing sword and my hand takes hold on justice, I will render vengeance on my adversaries, and I will repay those who hate me. And then Paul, of course, quotes Deuteronomy 32, 35. Romans 12, 17 through 19. Paul says, never pay back evil for evil to anyone. Respect what is right in the sight of all men. If possible, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. Now, Paul, of course, understands that sometimes it's not possible to be at peace with all men, but so far as it depends on you, stay at peace. Never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay. There is nothing more destructive than a heart full of revenge. People will live their whole lives with one goal, to get revenge on somebody who screwed them. Now, Solomon says, while you are waiting for God to bring justice on the evil that was done to you, you're supposed to wait for the Lord. Adam Clark says, in the meantime, pray for the conversion of your enemy, which I think is an excellent exhortation. We go now to Proverbs 20, verse 23. Differing weights are an abomination to the Lord, and a false scale is not good. I've already discussed that at Proverbs 20, verse 10. We'll skip that one. We'll go now to Proverbs 20, verse 24. Man's steps are ordained by the Lord. How then can man understand his way? Adam Clark's got a great statement here. He says, they who will carve for themselves shall cut their fingers. In other words, this proverb is aimed at those who try to live their life by the lights of their natural abilities. How then can a man understand his way? He can't. That's a rhetorical question. The answer is no. He can't understand where he's going to go. God ordains where you're going to go. He ordains your steps. If I had planned back when I was in high school that I was going to spend 23 years of my life in China, I never would have planned that in a million years. Man's steps are ordained by the Lord, not by your plans. Proverbs 20, verse 25, it is a trap for a man to say rashly, it is holy, and after the vows, to make inquiry. This is referring to a vow offering, which is a special kind of peace offering. The idea is, you say, God, if you will help me win this battle, I will pay a vow offering to you, I will make a sacrifice to you in thanks for what you've done. And the thing of which the man said it is holy refers to the offering he was going to make to the Lord when the Lord fulfilled his prayer request. So he says it's holy. Holy means separated to God. So his sacrifice is to be holy to God, separated to God as a sacrifice. And then after he makes the offering and God answers the prayer, then he says, maybe that's not what I meant. Or maybe God didn't really fulfill my prayer request. He's making inquiry as to see whether the vow is a good vow or not. He's making inquiry as to how he can get out of the rash vow. Now, no, there was a legal way to get out of a rash vow. In Leviticus 5, 4 through 6, we read, or if someone swears rashly to do what is good or evil, concerning anything a person may speak rashly in an oath without being aware of it, but later recognizes it, he incurs guilt in such an instance. If someone incurs guilt in one of these cases, he is to confess he has committed that sin. He must bring his restitution for the sin he has committed to the Lord. A female lamb or goat from the flock is a sin offering. In this way, the priest will make atonement on his behalf for his sin. Now, in that case, a man realizes he's made a rash vow, and he realizes it was a sin. He has to confess the sin. He has to make atonement for that sin by offering a sacrificial animal. That's not what Solomon is talking about in Proverbs 20:25. He's talking about somebody who's trying to get out of making the vow without going through any kind of confession of sin, without making any statement that he's done anything rash. So basically, the teaching of this proverb is, if you make a vow to the Lord, keep it. Don't try to get out of it. If you're worried about whether the vow was rash or not, you should have made that inquiry before you made the vow. Here's some other scriptures about making vows to God and keeping them. Ecclesiastes 5, verses 4 through 6. When you make a vow to God, don't delay fulfilling it, because he does not delight in fools. Fulfill what you vow. Better that you do not vow than that you vow and not fulfill it. Do not let your mouth bring guilt on you, and do not say in the presence of the messenger that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry with your words and destroy the work of your hands? Numbers 30, verse 2. When a man makes a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to put himself under an obligation, he must not break his word. He must do whatever he has promised. Deuteronomy 23, verse 21. If you make a vow to the Lord your God, do not be slow to keep it, because he will require it of you, and it will be counted against you as sin. We go now to Proverbs 20, verse 26. A wise king winnows the wicked and drives the threshing wheel over them. Winnows, of course, refers to throwing the wheat up in the air and letting the chaff be blown out from the wheat. And the idea here is that the evil people around the king, they're blown away like chaff. That's the first part of the verse. The second part of the verse, the king drives the threshing wheel over them. Now, that's serious business. Sometimes defeated POWs in ancient times had a threshing wheel, a plow, in other words, a disc harrow, if you think about a disc, run over the back of a prisoner, which is probably pretty painful, probably fatal. Well, the king's got to be rough. Now, it might not be an actual physical threshing wheel that the king is supposed to run over the backs of the evil people in his kingdom. It might be metaphorical for, we need to drive these people into exile, the king needs to kick them out of the country, or it might just be another severe punishment which would match the crime of the particular evil person. Might not necessarily deserve a threshing wheel, but maybe something a little less severe, maybe 39 stripes or something like that. But at any rate, the point is, the king's got to punish evil. Political and judicial leaders have to use harsh measures. There's no turning the other cheek for them. If they did, injustice would occur. And when Jesus talked about turning the other cheek, he was not talking about government officials. He was talking about private individuals who wanted to take revenge on people. We see that in the New Testament. Paul said governors not only had the option of capital punishment, they had the duty of capital punishment. Romans 13, 4. For government is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, because it, the government, does not carry the sword for no reason. A sword. What do swords do? They decapitate people. For government is God's servant, an avenger that brings wrath on the one who does wrong. No namby-pamby, wussy-pussy evangelicalism from the Apostle Paul. We go down to Proverbs chapter 20, verse 27. The spirit of man is the lamp of the Lord, searching all the innermost parts of his being. Now, what is this spirit that God uses to search the innermost parts of a man's being? Two options. John Gill says that this spirit is the rational soul of man, namely his conscience. The problem with saying that the spirit of man is the rational soul of man, his mind, if you will, is there are plenty of proverbs that say that man's rational natural abilities are deficient. For example, Proverbs 20, verse 24, in this very chapter, man's steps are ordained by the Lord. How then can man understand his way? So how can the spirit of man, his rational soul, be used as a lamp of the Lord to search the interior of a man and say, okay, here's a problem, here's a problem, here's a problem? So it's not really his rational mind, it's his conscience. As Gill and Clark suggest, here's what Gill says, the thoughts, intents, and purposes of a man's conscience, which are the things of a man that only the spirit of man knows. By this candle, or light, he can look into his own heart, the inmost recesses of it, and reflect upon his thoughts and schemes, and judge in some measure whether right or wrong. There is a conscience in man, which, unless seared, passes sentence on what is in man or done by him, and either excuses or accuses. And so that conscience, says Gill, is the lamp that the Lord uses to determine whether there's good or evil in a person. We read something similar from the Apostle Paul in Romans 2, verses 14 through 15. For when Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively the things of the law, these, not having the law, are a law to themselves, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness and their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending them. Well, that's reasonable, that the spirit of man that God uses as a lamp is his conscience, but there's another view. This assumes you hold a trichotomous view of man, which I realize is a minority position, but just bear with me and assume that for a minute, that man is body, soul, and spirit. The spirit is distinct from the soul. The soul is the mind, will, and emotions. We've already talked about the conscience, I guess, which is a part of the soul too. But then the trichotomy people, they say that a man's spirit is that which communes directly with God or the devil if it's fallen and depraved, but if it's redeemed, the spirit is the part of the non-material part of man that communes with God directly. And according to that view, it's that spirit illumined with the Holy Spirit of God. It is that spirit of man that searches him to see whether something's right or wrong. We read, for example, in 1 Corinthians 2, verses 10 through 11, "For to us God revealed them through the Spirit." The spiritual things of God revealed through the Spirit. "For the Spirit searches all things, even the depths of God. For who among men knows the thoughts of a man except the spirit of the man which is in him?" So that's how we know what God knows, is because of the spirit of the man which is in him. "Even so, the thoughts of God no one knows except the Spirit of God." So there we have the Spirit of God mingling with the spirit of man, giving light to the spirit of man. And so therefore, the spirit of man is a lamp, lighting up the interior of a man's consciousness so that he knows what's right and what's wrong. Now, of course, the dichotomists will say the spirit's the same thing as the soul. Okay, well, then God lights up the soul, which might include the conscience. So these two positions could be run together a little bit. We read in Proverbs 21:2, "Every man's way is right in his own eyes, but the Lord weighs the hearts." The Lord lights up a man's spirit and tells him what is right and what is wrong. Well, however you look at it, the bottom line is God knows what's going on inside of you. And if you want to know what's going on inside of you, you need to ask him so that you will quit rationalizing your sins and that you will let the Lord deal with your sins in a proper way, a non-condemning way, by the way. We go down to Proverbs 20, verse 28. Solomon says, "Loyalty and truth preserve the king, and he upholds his throne by righteousness." Compare Proverbs 20, verse 26. "A wise king winnows the wicked and drives the threshing wheel over them." We just talked about that. That proverb says a wise king must deal harshly with the wicked. But here in verse 28, the king deals kindly with the righteous. A king that reverses those two things, like our present government does today, that is an unjust government. Loyalty and truth preserve the king. Loyalty to righteous people, loyalty to God, truth. I mean, we just had a president of the United States. I won't mention his name. I don't want to use profanity on this podcast. He said that if you object to doctors and hospitals cutting off the breasts of little girls and doing gender assignment surgery on them, cutting off the penises of little boys before they're old enough to know what their favorite color is, and to do it without telling their parents, then that is hate, not love, says this president. That is racism, transphobia, homophobia, and every other smear word these radical woke leftists love to use. Well, that's what's running our country right now in our culture. That's not loyalty and truth preserving a king. That's not a king upholding his throne by righteousness. Proverbs 16:12 says, "It is an abomination for kings to commit wicked acts, for a throne is established on righteousness." I will say that about our current president. It is an abomination for a president to commit wicked acts. Good government is an incredibly great blessing for people, but bad government has the potential for terror. Ask any Chinese today, and you will know what that means. We go to Proverbs 20, verse 29. "The glory of young men is their strength, and the honor of old men is their gray hair." John Gill says that gray hair is an index of wisdom and prudence. Well, I don't know if that's true. I got a lot of gray hair. I guess it stands for wisdom and prudence. Other scriptures, Job 12, verse 12. Job is speaking and he says, "Wisdom is with aged men, with long life is understanding." Proverbs 16:31 says, "A gray head is a crown of glory. It is found in the way of righteousness." Now, this proverb talks about the strengths of different demographics of men, young men and old men. Young men are strong. Old men are wise. They should complement their strengths and not fight each other by concentrating on the other's weaknesses. We go now to Proverbs 20:30. "Stripes that wound scour away evil, and strokes reach the innermost parts." Now, I've already listed over and over and over again many, many verses in Proverbs and other scriptures that talk about the importance of discipline. so I won't read them again. But I will mention a problem in this particular verse. Stripes that wound, ooh, that sounds like wounding a child with corporal punishment, is okay. Well, here's a couple of options to answer that. It's the proud spirit that is wounded, not the flesh. Stripes that wound, it doesn't say stripes that wound the flesh. Every time you get whipped, every time I got whipped, my spirit was wounded because I was chastened for my sin and rebellion, even though I never got a scar on my flesh. Another answer to that is when the verse says that stripes that wound scour away evil, those stripes might not even be corporal punishment on a child. It just might be a mere metaphor for the vicissitudes of life. Things happen that are bad in life, and they scour away evil because they teach us humility and dependence on God. Strokes reach the innermost parts, the deepest part of our being, when we change our worldview about something. Ladies and gentlemen, we have finished this long chapter in Proverbs 20. We are now ready to go to Proverbs 21, which I will entitle The Proverbs of Solomon, Part 12. I hope you stay tuned for some more wisdom in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.